netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from fxguide.com.
This podcast is proudly brought to you by the new term at fxphd.com, with new Nuke, RealFlow, Houdini, Maya, Cinema 4D, Previz, and much, much more. Check it out now at fxphd.com and take your career to the next level.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. FX Guide was started in 1999 by three passionate visual effects artists. We wanted to learn, share, and document an industry that we love. For the past 14 years, that's what we've done, so much so that we've grown FX Guide to include more in-depth articles, coverage of films and TV shows as they are released, news, multiple audio and video podcasts. In fact, that same passion even led us to include training, which spawned FXPhD.com, our sister online training site. When we started, the business issues were more how to get the work done, both creatively and technically. But over the last few years, we've found ourselves more and more having to cover business issues as this industry of ours matured. Our podcast today is with David Yosis, lawyer at Washington, D.C.-based law firm Picard, Kentz, and Rowe. This is the firm that was engaged by anonymous visual effects artist and blogger VFX Soldier. He commissioned a feasibility study to address ways to help the visual effects industry that he feels is being harmed by subsidies. He's not alone, as this study was funded by readers of VFX Soldier's blog. Over 200 of them contributed a total of $13,000 via a Kickstarter-like campaign. Let's talk just a little bit about subsidies before we get to that interview. We all know the struggles visual effects companies have been facing. One of the biggest influences on the visual effects business has been the worldwide deployment of tax subsidies. These subsidies are now, in fact, integral to the way feature films are financed. No one's denying that the visual effects business is now a global industry. But if the work is being awarded based on artificial tax incentives, it distorts the market, and long-term that hurts both companies and artists. Competition is healthy, but it's not really competition when one area is providing tax incentives that the producer would be fiscally irresponsible not to take. The subject of tax subsidies is just huge, and I'd encourage you to check out some of the detailed writing that VFX Soldier has done on his blog at vfxsoldier.wordpress.com, and also Scott Squires has done quite a bit of great writing on this subject as well. I'll add links to both of these, as well as one to the article about this study that includes a link to the 25-page report. You'll find these in the podcast entry for this episode on FX Guide. So joining me now for the FX Podcast is David Yosis. David, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
So I'd like to start out by asking you to please tell us a little bit about yourself and the firm.
Sure. I'm an attorney here in Washington, D.C., and our firm is basically started about 3.5 years ago, and we are a group of people who have known each other for a while, who have worked in international trade law. Most of us at a large law firm here in Washington. We've all also done other things. I worked for the U.S. Trade Representative's office for a while. Andrew Kentz, who's the person who started us off, worked in Congress for a while as well. So we have a lot of experience doing these sorts of things. And one of the things that we wanted to do was we've done a lot of work basically for U.S. industries that have issues with international trade, with unfair competition from other countries, whether they're subsidies or other sorts of practices, and working with mostly very disparate industries, with a lot of people in a lot of different parts of the industry, different parts of the U.S., and working with them to try to come together and see if there's a way to address their problems. And we thought that being able to do that outside the structure of a big law firm was an easier way to do that and make the U.S. trade laws more accessible to industries that needed them. So VFX Soldier approached us a while ago and asked us to look at whether the trade laws could be used to deal with the VFX subsidies issue. And we did the report that he released not too long ago.
Right, and that study is titled The Feasibility Study on Subsidies to Film Production and Visual Effects. And let's jump into that now. It's
sure.
25 pages, and it's very detailed and very complex, but people should not be intimidated. It's very well laid out and presented, and I found it, it took me a couple readings to kind of get through it and digest it a little bit, but I think we can help simplify that for some people here and kind of go through it kind of point by point. And I think the thing that's important that I think Soldier even joked about on the initial post, visual effects artists are neither lawyers nor international trade experts. And so I think a lot of us are struggling a little bit with
sure.
some of these issues. And I've got some questions of my own, and also many people contacted me. I mentioned this on Twitter that I was going to do this interview, so I've got a bunch of questions that people emailed me. So let's start off with the study. The first part of the study sets out four conclusions, basically, and then examines the basis for those. And the first one is that subsidies for film production generally, and visual effects in particular, are large, pervasive, and distortive of international trade. And the thing that really struck me in that section was the comment that the accounting firm KPMG publishes a guide to the tax incentives provided mm-hmm. throughout the world. And it's the 2012 edition is 35 countries and runs 670 pages. So obviously there's a big business built up around this very thing.
Sure, there is. And I think a lot of people, there are a lot of people who will promote the industry in their particular area, their particular country, and make sure that everybody knows that there are incentives available to do work, whether it's in Vancouver or in Montreal or in Australia or in the UK or wherever. There are you know, certainly everybody wants to make sure that everybody knows that these incentives are available. So there's definitely a lot of information that's out there that says, you know, look, if you come and do your VFX work here or any other sort of film production or post-production activities here, here are the incentives that we provide. So there's plenty of information out there that tells you what in fact is available. And just talking to people in the industry, I mean, obviously subsidies are not the only issue that confronts people in the VFX industry. There are a lot of other things that are going on in the industry that make being successful in this business complicated. But certainly, I think virtually everybody recognizes that subsidies do play a big role in this, and that, you know, the decision on where do we go, where do we locate certain activities, is in large part dictated by subsidies. And I don't think that there's a lot of disagreement within the industry that plays a big role. People might disagree how big it is, but I think everybody agrees that it does play a role.
Right, and both in as I think it says in the study, that many people, well, some people undoubtedly derive a benefit from these subsidies, mm-hmm. there's also a detrimental effect, and that's what we're looking at here.
Right.
Also, one of the comments I hear a lot from people is the kind of the funny phrase, you know, live by the subsidies, die by the subsidies. And I think it's important to keep reminding people that, you know, no matter where you are on the scale right now of whether subsidies are helping you or hurting you, the way these subsidies are being applied are truly chasing the best deal. I mean, these are big companies. Mm-hmm. They're not doing anything evil. They're chasing the best deal they can get within the law. And you know, you may be riding high on your 25% subsidy, and the next day there's a 30% subsidy across the town or across the globe, and you're facing the problems that California, frankly, is facing right now.
Sure, and that's one of the things that happens with international trade agreements, is they sort of recognize if you're going to open up markets and if you're going to have free trade, which we have in all sorts of products now, you know, much more than we have at any time in the past, the more you open that up, the more possibility there is that people can use subsidies to enhance their competitiveness versus somebody else's. And so most trade agreements have rules that sort of limit how much you can use subsidies in order to do that, in order to keep a level playing field for everybody, which is the goal of having free trade, is to give everybody a chance to compete on a level playing field. And then the question is, what happens when a government says we want to help the industry in our jurisdiction to get an advantage over other people? If you're doing it just to help them for whatever reason, that's one thing, but when it becomes to get an advantage over somebody else, yeah, you're right. You can't blame people for taking advantage of it, but other governments then feel a need to respond, and you get into this cycle where, you know, people are just sort of outbidding each other with subsidies, and the idea of coming up with an agreement is to prevent that cycle from happening and to restrain it when it does.
And this is not unique to the visual effects industry, obviously. This is something that happens in a lot of industries. As you mentioned, a couple examples in the report –
Sure. Well, I mean, there are, you know, all sorts of industries that where there are subsidies, whether they're, you know, it's in agriculture, whether it's in, you know, steel production. A lot of the case law that has developed on disciplining subsidies comes out of the steel industry, where, you know, every country wanted to subsidize their own national producers for different reasons, and it happens in a lot of different industries where you do see this, where, you know, one country starts giving a subsidy and then the other country feels they need to match it, and you wind up in this cycle, and then the question is, how do you break that cycle?
One of the next things you go into here is the fact that there was a coalition led by the Film and Television Action Committee in 2007. That has tried to go at the World Trade Organization through a route, and that effort was not really successful.
That's right. And basically, there are there's a World Trade Organization which has evolved over the years, going back to 1947. But since 1994, there's been an agreement which right now pretty much every major economy in the world is part of. And it has enforceable rules on things, including subsidies. And basically, there are a couple of major rules, one of which prohibits certain kinds of subsidies, and another one that prohibits any country that belongs to the WTO from using subsidies in a way that harms the interests of another country that belongs to the WTO. But both of those are enforceable only by governments. So a government can invoke WTO arbitration against another government, saying you're providing subsidies that violate that violate the agreement, either because they're prohibited or because they're harming an industry in my country. But the problem is that governments have to do that. No individual people can do it. So in 2007, there was a coalition that was put together that laid out the case that the United States could make against subsidies being provided. In that case, they were specifically looking at Canada, but I presume they could have done other countries as well. And they went to the U.S. Trade Representative, which is the office in the U.S. government that deals with these sorts of things, and said, here's the case that you can make. Please bring a WTO case. And they said no. They didn't give a reason. They don't have to give a reason. They said that they didn't want to do it. Part of it may have been that they might have wondered whether it would be successful. They tend not to like to bring cases unless they know there's a very high chance that they're going to win. And it may have been in part that, you know, there are lots of people in the United States who also benefit from the subsidies, the film studios and so forth. And they just might have felt that politically it wasn't something that they wanted to take on. So, but whatever the reason was, and you know, we may never know for sure what exactly the reason is, they decided this wasn't something they wanted to do. And the WTO route, there's no what lawyers call a private right of action. You know, the industry can't do anything to enforce WTO rights. Only the government can, and the government has the discretion to decide whether they want to do it or not. And our sense looking at it was, yes, there probably would be a very strong legal case here. I think that the work that was done back in 2007 was basically right on. But you're still going to have that problem of, you know, if you want to go through the WTO, you need the U.S. government to buy into it. And for various reasons, they probably aren't going to be any more open to it now than they were then.
So we've kind of basically just in the last bit there summarized the second big conclusion of the study, which is that these subsidies likely violate existing trade agreements, international trade agreements, but those agreements are not readily enforceable.
Right.
So that leads us to the next one, which is probably the most complicated part, but let's go into it here. The countervailing duty law. And let me just read a little section here from the study. I'm not going to do a lot of this, but let me just read a little piece.
Okay, sure.
We believe that the U.S. countervailing duty, CVD law, is the most promising avenue for making progress in dealing with the harmful effects of subsidization in these industries. So this is not, though, very cut and dry. You go on to explain that, you know, it raises a bunch of controversial legal issues that may not by themselves create a solution, but that this seems like the most reasonable route going forward anyway to introduce a challenge that doesn't rely on the government.
You're right. It does get somewhat complicated. I'll try to do this as clearly as I can. So basically, the other thing the WTO agreement says is you've got issues where the government can sort of bring a WTO case and bring arbitration at the WTO saying your subsidies are a problem. The other thing that you're allowed to do under the WTO is you're allowed to put in place a tariff or a tax on imports into your country that are subsidized by another country and that are causing harm to an industry in your country. And we have implemented that in the United States through something called the countervailing duty law. And basically, one of the ways that we can respond to other countries providing a subsidy is we can respond to it not by, well, you know, perhaps we could do it by providing subsidy of our own to offset it. But one of the things that we can do is to say, if your subsidized product is causing harm to a U.S. industry and you want to bring it into the United States, what we're going to do is we're going to put a tax on it and make you, through that tax, pay back the subsidy before the product comes into the United States. And this is a law that's been there for a long time. And the difference between this and the other things is that if you meet the conditions for the law, there's no discretion. If you meet the conditions for the law, then the tariff does get applied. And so you don't have the sort of political issue that you do with going to the U.S. government and asking them to bring a case in the World Trade Organization.
All right. So the way I understand it, though, the complexity here, one of the complexities is that the general application of this law is based on physical imports. And so we're now talking about digital media. We're talking about movies that are primarily finished in the United States, but are shipped via the internet, most likely, finished shots, electronically transmitted. So that this would mean clarifying that, although there is some precedent for that, I believe.
That's right. So this is the thing. You know, the law was written back in the current version of the law was basically written in 1974. And so it's in a different world. And basically, when it's applied mainly to physical goods. And there are just a lot of questions. It certainly has never been applied in a digital context before. And so the question is, number one, could you do that? And then number two, if you can, how would you do it? And one of the things I think it's worth kind of taking a step back even before we get into that is – I would imagine that from the perspective of people who are listening to the podcast, the real issue is not whether the United States government can actually impose and enforce and collect all the subsidy money that's going to go into the U.S. Treasury. I mean, as taxpayers, we'd love it. You know, it will reduce the deficit, which I guess is a good thing. But basically, you know, that's not money that's coming to the industry. What we really care about is. Does it take away the incentive to locate production in another country in order to get a subsidy? And if it alters those incentives, then it achieves its purpose. So the idea here is if you were to go down this route, could you use this law in a way that actually changes people's behavior with regard to subsidies? And our conclusion is that we think at the end of the day you can. And in that sense, the first hurdle is, does the law even apply to these digital products? Because the way it's enforced is you wind up having to pay the tax when you bring something into the United States that's subsidized that was produced in another country. So are you – when you're doing something digitally, if you've got a shot that was produced in another country that benefits from a subsidy and you're downloading it in some way in the United States – are you in fact importing something? And the way the Customs Service looks at that is that yes, you are. And I also think it's important to recognize that for people who benefit from the subsidies and who might be inclined to challenge this, they rely on the U.S. government to enforce intellectual property laws with respect to these sorts of things. So I don't think I don't think anybody in this industry in particular would want to take the position that things that are trafficked over the internet across borders should absolutely be free from all government regulation completely. Because that means that, you know, pirated movies, for example, ought to be free of government regulation. I don't think anybody in this industry wants to take that position. So the government is always is involved, and everybody wants the government to be involved, even when things are going over the internet, which is largely unregulated. So the position that customs and other agencies that enforce intellectual property law and other trade agencies have come to the conclusion that, yes, even digital things that come over the internet, if they're coming from another country and they become a commercial product within the United States market, that, yes, that's imported. And the countervailing duty law says if something is produced in another country using subsidies and the imports of that product in the United States are causing harm to the U.S. industry, then the countervailing duty law applies. So even though it's never been done before, and I'm sure if you went to the agencies that actually enforce the law, they probably would kind of look at you funny when you first walk in the door. I think if they look at it, that they would conclude that, yes, in fact, these are imports and the law does apply.
Right. Well, like you said, it was written in 1974 and even 1994. So much has changed, even from 1994.
Sure.
In regard to what we do electronically versus physically, that, yeah, it seems like, you know, it seems like there's an argument to be made there. The one of my favorite people in the industry is fond of saying that, you know, it's not a matter of what's fair or what's right, but what leverage you have. And it seems like that's what you're looking for here, is a way to apply, you know, common sense, but also the law to this problem using mm-hmm. the statute.
Right. And I think the idea is that once you say, okay, that yes, the law can apply to these products. And there are a lot of different issues. We go into it in detail, largely, I think, just to kind of show that this is, you know, we have looked at this. We've looked at this from a lot of different angles, and we want to put it out there for people if they're actually interested in looking at this. And I'm sure there are a lot of people on all sides of the issue who want to look at it. So we wanted to put it out there, make it available for people to look at and come to their own conclusions on. But our conclusion is basically that the law would apply. And then the question is, if you did apply the law, what would happen? And it would not – and I think it's important to recognize it would not be perfect. It would not offset every possible subsidy that there is, because there are all these conditions that you have to meet in order to actually have the law apply, first of all. And then which you're not going to be able to do for everything, but you can prioritize and start with the things that are most important and see what effect that can have in the marketplace. But then also, the way that the countervailing duty law is typically applied, because it has historically been applied only with regard to physical goods, it's applied by customs when the goods cross the border. And that mechanism isn't available for digital products. And that's going to create some complications. Just in sort of practically making it work. And some of those we've identified, and we think that they can be addressed. Others are going to be harder to address. But, and again, we've gone through that in some detail for people who are interested in the details. I think the bottom line is, will you be able to get at enough subsidies in a way that is enforceable enough that it actually has a market effect?
Right. It's almost like the threat itself of the fact that maybe a year after the production is done, that these tariffs could be applied, basically negating the original benefit.
Right.
Which could be enough of a deterrent in itself.
Right. And I think that's the idea. The goal isn't to get money to collect for the U.S. Treasury. The goal here is to change the incentives about using subsidies in the first place. And if you can do that, because right now there's really no incentive for anybody to sit down around a table and say, subsidies are a problem in this industry, they're distorting trade, let's come up with some rules that we all agree to live by where, you know, maybe you can have some subsidies in some situations or at a certain level, but beyond that, we're all going to agree we're just not going to push this subsidy race to some extreme level that we've seen lately. And right now, there's no incentive to do that. If people believe that the countervailing duty law can work, then I think there is an incentive for everybody to sit down at the table and come up with something that maybe is more comprehensive.
Right. And I should be clear, everything we're talking about here really is talking about international law. We obviously have the same type of thing happening in the United States between states with Louisiana, sure, North Carolina, you name it. Everybody's mm-hmm. jumping on right. the bandwagon to do this. And this would have nothing to do with that. That's a whole separate thing.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So that's one of the things that the countervailing duty law does not address is subsidies within the United States. And it only affects subsidies on products that are brought into the United States. Other countries have the countervailing duty law. Probably the way this industry is structured, it probably wouldn't help them. I mean, Canada has the same law. They've applied it to U.S. products in the past. Other, you know, the European Union has the same law. They apply it. It probably wouldn't work. Those countries could also go to the World Trade Organization and say that the U.S. state subsidies are causing problems for their exports to the U.S., that they can't compete in the U.S. The United States, you know, maybe is putting a countervailing duty on their exports, so, you know, they can't subsidize, but there are people in the U.S. who are subsidizing and taking work from them, and their governments might be willing to go to the World Trade Organization over that. So, you know, using the trade laws in different ways is possible. The countervailing duty law does not solve every problem, and I think it's important to recognize that going up front. But can it affect things? I think our sense is that yes, it could, and could it affect enough things to matter to make it worth doing? Our sense is that yes, it probably could.
Okay, so let's assume then the next thing the report kind of goes to is assuming that we're going to use the CVD approach. What do we need to do? And the first thing mentioned there is organizing industry participants to invoke the trade laws, and this one concerns me, and several of the people that wrote me questions concern me, because there's been a very active push for many years to form a trade organization, and it has not gone well, including recently. And I think part of it is competition. Part
sure.
of it is that a lot of these companies have offices now in the subsidized locations, whether they've been forced to do that. Well, they have been forced to do that, or they are in a subsidized location. And mm-hmm. so they're less likely. It almost comes to, I've been saying for a while, it almost comes to you need an international trade organization fighting for the industry as a whole globally. And then you may need a separate mm-hmm. trade organization that fights for U.S. interests and another one that fights for California interests. I mean, it really does get that granular. And mm-hmm. the problem is, in most cases, you know, and this can't be unique to visual effects. I mean, we have multinational corporations now that must face this on a daily basis, is mm-hmm. representing their interests globally as well as locally.
Absolutely, that's true. I think, you know, we've seen it. You've seen this in a lot of different industries that have dealt with this. One of the countervailing duty and trade law cases that's been, if you do follow this sort of stuff, it's been in the news a lot lately, have been on solar cells from China. And that was one of the big I personally am not working on that one, so it's easy for me to talk about it. That's a case where most of the U.S. producers either were in fact international companies, and most of them did a lot of business with China in terms of their, you know, getting their supplies from China, or just having business relationships with China, doing business there. And there was a lot of hesitancy over, can we actually bring the U.S. industry together and agree on bringing a trade case? Eventually they did, with all but one company being completely anonymous. So there was one company that was willing to put their name to the petition, and then a whole bunch of others that did so anonymously. And what happened there was, first the United States did a countervailing duty and anti-dumping case, then the European Union did one, and now everybody's sitting down saying, "Oh gosh, maybe we really ought to sit down and do some sort of an agreement on what kind of subsidies are allowed in this sector." And I think that's sort of the model that you'd want to see here. I think it's true, and we've seen this in the industries that our firm works with. Sometimes you're in a position where there's nothing that the U.S. industry agrees on other than the fact that they have a trade problem. They disagree on all kinds of other things. They're all competitors with each other. And so they work together on the trade issue and agree to that, you know, they put together a very loose organization that is the purpose of which is to use the trade laws and nothing else. And the companies all do, whatever else they're going to do in the industry, either on their own or through other organizations. There are other industries that we work in where first they get organized to work on trade issues, and then because they've never been able to get organized before to work on other issues. So then first they get organized to work on the trade issues, and then that organization develops and starts working on other projects as well. What's best for this industry is really for people in the industry to decide. But I think you need some sort of organization simply because the way the countervailing duty law works is it doesn't work to benefit individuals. It works to develop the industry. And so they look at, is the industry behind this, and is the industry injured by the subsidies? And they try to look at both of those questions as holistically as they can. So I think you need some degree of organization to sort of bring people together, and also, frankly, to make sure that the lawyers aren't in charge, that people in the industry are in charge, and that the lawyers are doing things that people in the industry have decided that they want done, and that they don't take over and just start doing things that are in the lawyers' interest. Lawyers, I think, work a lot better when they're advocating for their clients. Rather than trying to take care of themselves. And so something we feel very strongly about is that it's really the industry that needs to make the big decisions and call the shots. You need some sort of organization in order to do that.
Well, and also, I believe you mentioned in the report that that's also the path generally that funding comes for these types of actions.
Sure. And I mean, that's, you know, to do this sort of thing actually requires a fair amount of work. There are a lot of technical issues. Fortunately, the agencies involved have gone to electronic filing because it used to generate a huge amount of paper to do these sorts of cases. So you do spend a lot of time and effort that goes into doing this. And that does cost some money. I mean, one of the things our firm has tried to do is to recognize, especially with industries that have a lot of different individuals and a lot of different interests are hard to pull together, that, you know, it's important to work with them to make sure that they can do that, that they're not priced out of this. So we do make an effort to recognize that, but it does take a lot of work, and so therefore it does take some funding.
Right. Somebody asked, I'm going to jump to a question, how much something like this would typically cost? I know it's going to be hard to narrow down, but their question was basically, sure. is it $10 million and take 5 years, or is it $100,000 and take 6 months? Is there any kind of is there any idea? Is the answer yes?
I think a lot of it depends, and a lot of it depends on different things. I would say it's probably – I can certainly say it's probably in between those things, but – That's something that I think we'd have to work out. A lot of it depends on how broad or how narrow you would want to frame a case. So, what exactly are the when you say you want to bring a case? What exactly is the product that we're talking about? How many people are there who produce that product? From whom we have to get information? How many different countries are we talking about that we're going to talk about the subsidies from? And so there's just a lot of different questions. So the answer really is it depends. Once you actually file a countervailing duty case, you normally get a decision within roughly a year. So it takes some time to prepare the case and get it ready to be filed. You normally get a decision relatively quickly. And then different aspects of that decision can be subject to appeals and so forth. But the initial decision is relatively quick by legal standards.
All right. I hate to do comments on internet blogs, but kind of have to since this whole thing started on an internet blog.
Absolutely.
There was a comment somewhere, I think it might have been on Soldiers, that you know, the effort that happened in 2007, there was a feeling that the that it was a black hole in terms of legal fees, and it got stronger than that. I mean, I think they were outright saying that they felt that the lawyers were enjoying the money. It was just an endless fund of, they were considering an endless fund of money for this process. How do you reassure people that that doesn't happen?
Well, I think there are a couple things. One is, it's one of the reasons I think you want an organization. You want somebody who's going to be, who's, you know, at least some people who are out there in the industry who are accountable and who can say, you know, we're the ones who are looking at this. You know, we're the ones who are saying, you know, we think it's worth spending money to do A, B, and C, and it's not worth spending money to do X, Y, and Z. So you've got some people who are members of the industry that people can approach and talk to who can take some ownership of that. And also, I think, you know, the idea of the countervailing duty case is, you do see the different stages, and you see what's going on. You know, part of the problem with the going the route of going to the World Trade Organization is you go to the U.S. government and they make a decision and they're not accountable. It's totally discretionary. And so you go to the U.S. government, you lay out the case, they say no, there's nothing to do. And then you sort of say, well, why did we spend all that money? And, you know, we got such an unsatisfactory answer. That's one of the reasons that we would suggest not going down that route. Whereas with the countervailing duty case, at least you've got a public record. If it's not successful, you know why it's not successful. And then you can step back and say, okay, we've learned something here. We've learned it wasn't successful for this reason. Is there something we can change and do differently, and is it worth trying to do that? You at least get that feedback. Or you bring a case, but it turns out not to be effective for some reason. Well, then you can say, well, we've learned something. In order to make it effective, we need to do this other thing. Can we do that? Can we get the industry to support that and fund that? You at least get that feedback going down this road, and I think that's useful, and it enables more people to be part of that discussion and part of that decision making process.
Okay, so in terms of a body, let's say that the visual effects companies are too afraid of being blacklisted, which I don't know if that's a reality or not, but I mean, it's one of those things people throw out all the time. But let's say that the visual effects companies just flat out won't do it, flat out just, you know, are not interested in becoming that organization. Could an honorary society fit that bill? We do have an organization called the Visual Effects Society that has traditionally shied away from these types of issues. They're a nonprofit. They're an honorary society. They are international as well. Would they be possibly an organization that could be invoked into this role?
Sure. To be honest, I don't know that much about that particular organization. And I know that, you know, basically it's always possible. I mean, you know, that you can use an existing organization or you can create a new one. And that really is up to the people who are in those things. I'm not sure I could speak for that particular organization. And people do in these cases rely on existing organizations. Sometimes it's easier to create a new one. That's really the people in the industry's call, how to do that.
What about a union? I mean, we don't have a union right now, but would a union be empowered to represent that type of a case?
Yeah, usually when the Commerce Department sort of makes the decision, have you demonstrated enough support from the industry? They generally look at, basically their point of view is, for purposes of the industry, either management or the workers can speak for a company. And so if there's a union and the union supports it, then that company is considered to support it. Unless management comes in and says, no, we're actively opposed, then that company is considered neutral. So if you have a union, you can do that. You don't have to have a union. I'm not actually personally aware of any case where people have usually if you're organizing people enough to say that the workers support this, you've also organized them enough to have a union. So, you know, usually if you're basing industry support on labor, it's through a union, but doesn't have to be. That's not a rule in the law. But yes, the workers, you can do this through the workers in the industry. You also have a situation where if a company is their interests are primarily, they are producing in the United States, but their interests are primarily in the other country, and they say that they're opposed, but they're really opposed because of their interests in the other country, that opposition can be disregarded. You also have situations where, as long as there's somebody in the industry who's willing to be public and to be officially the petitioner in a case, people can support anonymously. So the U.S. government knows that they support it, but that is never released publicly. And a lot of times people do make use of that precisely because they do business in the other country or they have relationships with that country, and they would just prefer that people not know what their position is.
I guess my thought is that you have a very complex issue here on the visual effects company side because frankly Sony, ILM is owned by Disney. You have basically studios that own visual effects companies now,
mm-hmm. Sure.
As well. So they're benefiting from the subsidies as well as owning companies, and it's all getting very complex, which I guess all these issues are very complex, so none of these things
right.
are unsurmountable. But
right, exactly. I think that's our view of the countervailing duty law in general, is that it's very complex, but it is all of the different obstacles are surmountable, we think.
Okay, so let's say we've got an organization, because that's the first thing you say we need. That's going to speak for the industry. The next step is identifying an initial scope and assemble the required information and support. That's pretty clear cut, I guess.
Technically, identifying an initial product is actually probably the biggest strategic decision that you make, because what you're going to do is you're going to write a legal definition and says, this is the product that we say is subsidized, and these are the countries that are providing the subsidy, and this is the product that we want a countervailing duty order applied to. And if you write that product too narrowly, if you write that definition too narrowly, it's got to describe the product as it enters the United States. The thing that's made in the other country that comes into the United States. If you write it too narrowly, then someone can just say, well, we're just going to change our business practices a little bit. We're going to change what's actually done in the U.S. versus what's done in the foreign country. And we're going to be able to say, oh, the thing that we're actually bringing into the country doesn't fall within that definition. So you've got to frame it broad enough so that the order will be effective. But then once you write that description defines the industry that produces whatever your definition is, the U.S. industry that produces that thing, whatever it is, that's what you have to show. That's the industry that supports it, and that's the industry that's injured.
Right. I mean, I think you make a good point in the thing of being the danger of being too narrow and too broad, that they both
right.
have equal peril in jeopardizing the effectiveness.
Right. So actually figuring out what that's going to be, and there's probably more than one way to do it, and there's probably probably some ways are easier than others. And what you might want to do is start with something that's relatively narrow, but also relatively easy to put together, and do that and let that be your test case for a lot of these legal issues. So you're not putting as big of an investment in up front. You're recognizing that the first order you get might not be as effective as you want, but at least you've got that to sort of test your legal theories to see if this is going to work at all. And then if you do and you're successful, then you can come in and do a second petition later that's a bit broader. I mean, those are options to consider. So those are all things that I think, once you sit down and say, who actually is willing to support this, who actually is willing to be part of an organization, and sit down and make that decision, I think that's an important decision that has to be made. And it's really something, I mean, you obviously need legal advice on how to do that, but it's really a decision that needs to be made by the people in the industry.
Well, the whole thing about circumventing the rules is very important. And I mean, even with the subsidies right now, I mean, I've been trying to figure out what the enforcement mechanisms are, because I've heard stories of shots being worked on in one location, but then quote unquote finaled in a location that has a better subsidy amount, you know, because who's sure. really monitoring that? I mean, the file gets shipped somewhere and it gets, mm-hmm. you know, who's really, nobody's tracking mm-hmm. that type of individual data. You know, it's just broad accounting reporting. So
sure.
It's a very interesting, you know, there's ways around everything, I guess. And so it's sure. very important, as you say, to really focus this and narrow it down. So we're talking about then the next step then would be to get all that organization and then file the petition. And then that's just the beginning of the process in some ways, right?
In some ways, yes. I mean, you know, then the agencies consider the petition, and certainly the petitioners have a role in making arguments, providing information, especially on the injury side. And that's a process, as I said, it takes about a year, sometimes a little longer than a year to actually get a decision. And the domestic industry can be involved at every step of that process. And then once an order does, assuming you're successful and there is an order, then monitoring that, making sure that the annual reviews actually happen, making sure that it's actually being applied correctly, you know, all of that is something that the industry can be part of. So it is sort of a long-term, in some ways it's a long-term commitment to actually be involved in this. But the industry can always decide, you know, through that process, what exactly it wants to participate in, what it doesn't want to participate in, what's worth spending effort on, what's not worth spending effort on. Those are things different industries approach that differently. But that's something that you can decide as you go through it. But as long as this is in place, you know, yeah, there's always opportunities to be involved and to shape how it's being applied.
Okay. Well, do you think we've done justice to the actual document before we get into questions?
Sure.
Is there anything else that you could think of that we've skipped?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I'd, you know, be interested in what sort of questions people have, and that you've been hearing from folks in the industry.
Do we know the real total dollars spent worldwide on this on American productions? I guess we could look at box office and production spending and stuff, but you know, mm-hmm. we got to be talking quite a significant amount of money.
I think so. I mean, I think you know you definitely know. Certainly how much each individual jurisdiction says that they're providing in subsidies. I mean, one of the difficulties here, because so much of this trade does go online, is that no one is actually collecting trade statistics. I can tell you how much steel was imported in the United States last year. I can tell you how much lumber was imported in the United States last year. I can tell you, our firm does work for the lumber industry, and I can tell you that you know, Canada provided 29.3% of the lumber that was sold in the United States in March of this year, because you can track that. You can get that data. That data doesn't exist for this industry, at least not publicly. And so that's one of the things that we would have to do if you were to bring a countervailing duty case is actually try to get some of that data and actually research that, because it isn't something that's actually readily available.
It would be very difficult to track and get that information, I'm sure. It would be easier to get the number of artists who have left the industry or left the states to chase the work. So,
sure.
But I don't know that that's a valid number in terms of damages. Somebody asked, can you put a percentage guess on the likelihood of succeeding? You know, and I'm not talking exactly, but are we talking a 5% chance? Are we talking a 95% chance? I mean, I guess...
That's always a really difficult thing. I mean, you know, lawyers are always people always ask that, and it's always a really hard thing. I guess I would say I'd probably put it into two parts. One is just if you were to just sort of go in and say, does the law apply to these products? I mean, that's a yes or no question. I think the odds are probably better than 50-50 that the answer ultimately is yes. Although how hard it will be to get to that answer is another question. You know, how receptive will the agencies be? You know, I mean, one thing is you walk in and they say, yeah, we've been thinking about this for a while and we totally agree with you. And it's a conversation that's over in 5 minutes. It could be that you file a petition, the agencies reject it, and you have to go to court and have a court decide. And that could take years before you get a final decision. So, I mean, that's very difficult to predict. You then have a question of, will you eventually be successful? I think, having looked at the arguments, I think we have the better argument that, yes, it does apply, but predicting what a court will do or what an agency will do is always very difficult. That's the sort of the initial stage. Then you have the question of, okay, the law does apply. Can you do it in a way that's effective? And that's more difficult, but that's a sliding scale. You're going to do anything that's 100% effective? No, because you're not going to address U.S. state subsidies. You're not going to address every country. You're not going to address every product.
Right. You said you have to go after each one of these things almost individually.
Right. Certainly the products and the foreign countries, not necessarily the subsidy programs. But you certainly would have to do that. And so it's not going to be comprehensive. Whatever you do, there may be ways in which people can set things up to try to avoid the duty, which may or may not eventually get collected. But on the other hand, your goal isn't to collect back every dollar of subsidy that's being provided elsewhere. Your goal is to change incentives. And so if that's what you're doing, then it's sort of a sliding scale. You know, will you be able to do enough to actually change incentives and make a difference? I think once you've decided that the law applies, the odds of that are relatively high. You know, how effective is it going to be, and how much change are you going to be able to affect? That's really hard to predict going in.
But doing nothing,
I can predict that if you do nothing, then you won't have any effect at all. That's easy.
One of the commenters asked about the Department of Commerce. I guess they'd be involved in this decision making as well. And
sure.
They brought up the appointment of Penny Pritzker as possibly an obstacle based on her reputation.
A lot of the decisions here are made at a technical level. There's an agency, the Department of Commerce is someone sort of said the Department of Commerce is like half of Noah's Ark. It's got one of everything. There's one agency in the Department of Commerce that handles virtually anything you could possibly imagine. And there's one particular agency that deals with the anti-dumping and the countervailing duty laws. And they have their own staff. This is what they do. This is what they do all the time. Largely, these decisions are made at that level. And ultimately, you know, the agencies do have a lot of discretion in the way that they apply the law. But at the end of the day, whatever decisions they make, they have to make on the record. They have to give reasons for it. And those decisions are reviewable by courts. And those courts give them those courts give them some deference, where the law just sort of says, use your best judgment and, you know, sort of, you know, decide what's reasonable based on the particular facts of a given case. But there are standards in the law, and those standards they are going to be accountable to the courts on how they apply those standards. So do they have some room for discretion? And does politics sometimes play a role in how they use that discretion? Yes, sometimes. But by and large, the basics of the law are things that have to be applied. And it's the Commerce Department basically handles the part of this of basically, first of all, does the domestic industry support the petition and should we start investigations? And then what they investigate is they investigate the subsidies. And they say, yes, these products are subsidized, and here's the amount of the subsidy. There's also a group called the International Trade Commission, which is independent of the administration. It's six members. By statute, they have to be three Democrats and three Republicans. And they're appointed for fairly long terms by, I think they're like nine-year terms. And so you've got this sort of independent body, and what they look at is the domestic industry injured? And what's the effect of these subsidized imports on that domestic industry? And that's the group that investigates that. And both of them have to make an affirmative finding. Commerce has to find, yes, there are subsidies, and the International Trade Commission has to say, yes, they're injured. And those two agencies are working in parallel throughout all of this.
Would there be an advantage in teaming up with live action production folks on this fight in terms of, you know, there's been a huge displacement of production people as well, but would it make sense to team up, or would it make more sense to be more narrowly focused on staying focused on visual effects?
That's a good question. a lot of that depends on how much interest there is in both of those industry groups. If you're working together, I mean, certainly some of the legal issues, you know, does the law apply, and so forth, are things that both groups would have in common. On the other hand, when you bring a petition, it's got to be on a specific product. So if your product is all live action films, then that's one product with one industry. If you're just doing visual effects, then that's another industry with another product. At some point, those products get merged together.
Right. I mean, I guess thought would be most every major box office movie nowadays is a visual effects movie, and most often combine live action with visual effects. So we would
right.
be brothers in arms in that regard.
Right. So it, depending on how you define the product, you might be able to define a product that covers everything, but that might get too complicated to do. You might want to do them as separate products. So those are the sorts of strategic decisions that depend on who actually is supporting this and who you're actually able to bring together to work with. And it may be, you may find that it's easier to work together. You may find that it's easier to work separately. You may find that it's easier to start with one, and if that's successful, the other comes in behind them. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And I think that's something that people in all of the affected industries would have to work out and to decide what's the best way to go forward.
I mean, I guess on the last page of the document, you actually talk a little bit about strategy and the fact that, you know, one of the important things is how this story is played out once things start to move forward. And in fact, I've even had some worries that making such a strategy public at this point is a bit risky in some ways. because obviously there's a lot of money on the side of, you know, subsidies.
Sure.
As we've talked about. So do you think that, I mean, you said, it says strictly right here, opponents of any CBD action are likely to be well-organized and well-funded. So obviously, you know, a ragtag bag of artists is not going to be enough to mount a defense against that kind of opposition. Can you see any other steps or ways forward to get these subsidies, you know, backed away from in some way? I mean, I hesitate to even use that sentence because it's not even
sure.
valid. They're so endemic to the way movies are funded now without going through all this. I mean, this seems like a very well thought out, deliberate approach to the only real angle I can see to go after subsidies.
Yeah, I think And this is, and again, this is true in a lot of different industries. Once subsidies become endemic, there are a lot of people whose business model is based around them, and they want to defend that. And again, if somebody's giving you free money, you're going to take it. You know, why not? So the question is, how do you change the incentives? And if you can't change the incentives by, sometimes you can do it by organizing politically, and as you say, you know, if you've got a ragtag group, to use the words that you had there, are you going to be able to match the people who are getting this, who are benefiting from the subsidies, in terms of, you know, your lobbying clout on Capitol Hill and all of that sort of thing? Probably not. Which is why I think the countervailing duty law, while it has its problems, absolutely, and it has its challenges and difficulties, our sense when we looked at this was that this is at least something that is within the power of the industry to do. That people can come together, and if you can invoke the law and have it apply, it is something where, I won't say politics is completely absent from it, but where the basic application of the law is something that, you know, where the agencies basically have to follow the law, and, you know, the law is there for industries to use. So I think that that this route, while it has its problems, it at least allows you to sort of get past that initial issue of do we have the political clout to matter here? How do we get some leverage in order to get people to start thinking about things other than subsidies? in the way that they make sourcing decisions. I think if you're going to get somewhere, you know, a more legal approach is the way to go, and the countervailing duty law is the thing that we think gives you the most leverage.
Well, I think that's a good place. I do want to finish with just reading the very last paragraph of the report, because I think we need to talk about this, and then I'll let you go. While subsidies are clearly a major problem in the entertainment industry, they are also not the only problem. We repeatedly have seen the spin-off benefits of working collaboratively within the industry on trade issues, many of which were not foreseen when trade relief was initially under discussion. We would advise you to consider these possible benefits in devising any plan going forward. I think that's very powerful. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. We've seen this in a lot of the industries that we've worked with, where especially industries that have had trouble organizing in the past, where people say, okay, we're going to come together, we're going to work, we've identified a trade problem, we're going to come together and work on it, we want to file a case. And then as they do that, having worked together on this, they just start identifying other issues. Part of them are things that they may have known about all along and just have never been able to organize around before. Sometimes it's in the process of doing a trade case. One of the things we talked about is how hard it is to actually sometimes get data on exactly how much money are we talking about here, exactly how much production is benefiting from subsidies, where in fact is all this stuff coming from. And in the process of doing a case, you wind up pulling a lot of that information together. Some of that's going to be confidential information that doesn't get released publicly, but a lot of it is. And you wind up learning a lot more about the industry and learning a lot more about the way different things are happening and different things are structured. And as you learn those things, you might say, oh, well, you know, here's something we can address. Oh, here's something that we can work on. And the things that you didn't even know about when you started doing the trade case. And you know, we've certainly seen that in a lot of the industries that we've worked in. So it is something to consider, especially. I mean, I can't say that I'm an expert in any of this, but just having read some of the blogs and having talked to some people, I've heard a lot of people talk about how hard it is to sort of organize things in the visual effects industry, and how many different perspectives there are, and how hard it is to kind of come together and agree on an approach. And maybe it's possible. I don't know. Maybe it's possible people come together to work on the trade issue, and then it becomes possible to address other issues as well. Maybe people come together to work on the trade issue and say, we're going to agree to disagree on everything else, and the only thing we're going to work on together is the trade issue, and that's fine. I do think it's worth considering. What's the benefit of coming together? Coming together and working on this has a benefit in itself, and that also I think is something people need to consider, and whether this is something that they want to pursue and want to support.
Right. Well, the current strategy of basically doing nothing really has proven to be a loser. So I think, mm-hmm. as you say, you often discover things on the journey that if you didn't take the journey, you would not have discovered. So
sure.
I think that's a good place to end, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us here.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity to do it.
Well, thanks to David for doing that. I think he helped clear up a lot of questions people had about the subsidy study. So hope you enjoyed that, and I hope we got most of the questions people submitted answered. My takeaway from this interview is that the visual effects business is a very mature business now. We create a product that makes billions of dollars for very large companies that operate globally. As an industry, I wonder if we're working towards playing at their level as an equal partner. What can we as artists do? Well, 200 of you made this study possible. But as David made clear, the path forward probably requires a more official and solid industry support. As artists, in my opinion, the most important thing we can do is band together globally as well as locally. We have issues that the business faces on a universal level: fixed bidding, crazy schedules, working conditions, payment, credits. You can start making a list or go to a trade show like IBC, SIGGRAPH, NAB, or attend one of the VFX town halls or catch up the videos of those. What you'll hear is there's way more commonality than differences, especially among the artists. Be creative, get connected, share information. One blogger with 200 other people was able to get this study done. What else can we do? Big issues today, but if you made it this far, thank you, and I encourage you to send us feedback on the FX Guide homepage using the Contact Us link. We really like to hear from you about these issues.
While you're there, check out the FX Insider program. Everything we do here at FX Guide is free to you. We don't slather the site with banner ads, and over the years people have said, hey, how can I help support the site? So we created the FX Insider program, where members support us through their contributions. As a thanks for those donations made as part of the program, we give you special access to additional content, member-only articles, additional breakdowns of effects scenes, and more. Details, fxguide.com, click the FX Insider tab. In addition to this FX podcast, we produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases as well as classic films. It's visual effects artists taking both a positive and critical look at visual effects. And then, my must-listen, can't-get-enough-of-it podcast, the RC Podcast, where Mike Seymour and Jason Wingrove cover the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. And it changes daily, so you really have to keep up with it, and they do a very good job of keeping you informed about the latest, not only gear, but also techniques and personal experience. And if you prefer video podcasts, we also do an HD video podcast, FX Guide TV. And as I mentioned, we have a sister site, fxphd.com, that offers online visual effects training, and a new term has just started there with an incredible lineup of great professors and courses. So that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.